Ascot, the Royal Racecourse has rocked British racing by quitting the Racecourse Association. We cover that, the Guineas, Punchestown and a major blow for Paul Nicholls in this week's edition of The Front Page. Yes, so a bank holiday Monday morning bombshell for British racing to take in today. We'll have more on the Guineas and Punchestown later on, but we are very much going to concentrate on the Ascot announcement that came at 9 a.m. today, and it was that Ascot, Britain's number one racecourse, arguably the most famous racecourse in the world, is to leave the Racecourse Association, the trade body that represents Britain's racecourses, at the end of this year. Because Ascot has not been satisfied about the RCA's attempts, efforts to meaningfully change its governance and structure. Ascot's chief executive, Felicity Barnard, was quoted in a statement this morning. To paraphrase what Felicity said, it was that the decision to move away from the RCA was not taken lightly. She said that it was in the long-term health of the sport that Ascot did that. She explained that since the 3rd of March, Ascot and other signatories to a letter to the RCA that included involved the Jockey Club and other members of the large racecourse group, namely Goodwood, Newbury and York, had been consistent in saying that they believed that governance reform was necessary within the RCA. Felicity goes on to end the statement by saying, regrettably, sufficient progress has not been made. We remain committed to working collaboratively within the industry to enable Ascot to continue to contribute to the shared success of the sport. Yes, a massive move there by Ascot, led by Felicity Barnard. Ascot had been clear in the letter of March the 3rd that we referenced earlier on that there needed to be significant change, significant reform plan put forward by the Racecourse Association, the trade association body that represents Britain's racecourses within the BHA and is a shareholder and member of the BHA, that a reform plan had to be put forward by the end of April. Ascot believes that a plan has not been put forward, and or a sufficiently good plan has not been put forward, and is therefore going to leave the RCA by the end of the year. Ascot, as I say, was not alone in being a signatory to this letter to the RCA from March the 3rd. Also signed up to that letter was the Jockey Club and the other large independent racecourses, Goodwood, Newbury and York. Chester is also an LI. It was in the same position, but it hadn't signed up to the letter. So Ascot is going. That is going to have huge ramifications for the sport. Jonathan Harding, first of all, you've been speaking to the Jockey Club. Just update us as to what their position is.
Yes, so I think we were quite surprised actually to learn that they have not immediately rode in behind Ascot and said that they're going to be leaving the RCA. They have seen enough encouraging signs from the conversations to at least give it 12 weeks. They've suggested that there is a 12-week governance review going on at the moment, although that's not been confirmed by the RCA. But they have essentially reiterated their position from that original letter, which is that we need to see changes to the board. We need the larger courses to be represented properly. There's been this sort of disquiet around whether the larger courses are properly represented alongside the smaller ones, each having a vote each, despite having very different business models. They have given the RCA until the end of July, and then they say with sadness, if they have not seen enough change, if they've not seen this governance reform, they will be forced to not renew their membership going into 2027.
Now, as it stands, we haven't yet heard what the position is of the large independent racecourses that aren't Ascot, so we'll say York, Goodwood, Newbury and Chester. We have heard that we won't hear from the Racecourse Association today, so they won't be responding to Ascot's decision. But Maddie Playle, this is massive on a number of levels. First of all, if we just try and put it in a bit of context, this all came really in response to what has been playing out over the last 18 months, 2 years or so, in that Lord Charles Allen came in, was installed eventually as BHA chair. He put forward plans to reshape, drastically alter the governance structure of the sport, including with a fully independent BHA board. Those plans have not come to fruition. Charles Allen, in the end, was in effect forced to resign from the BHA, and we've gone back to the status quo. Ascot, the Jockey Club and the LIs believed that the RCA structure was one of the reasons why that all played out as it did, and Ascot have taken the decision to move.
Yeah, I'm obviously a little bit more detached from this story than yourself and Jonathan Lee, but what I can say is you have to recognise the stature that Ascot have in all this. You know, as you mentioned at the top of the show, they are one of the most powerful racecourses in Britain. You know, the Royal Meeting is one of racing's biggest assets, and their standing is incredibly powerful. So the fact that although they are somewhat united within these large independents, the groups of racecourses, the fact that they've made the decision to leave the RCA really, I guess, shows a carry-on from that sort of discontent surrounding the structure of the RCA and ultimately in the way the sport's being run and the way that decisions are being made, and they're not happy with the lack of progress. Now, obviously, Lord Allen and his plans to develop that independent BHA board fell through, and this is a continuation of that. But I can perfectly understand Ascot's stance in the fact that, you know, they laid out their desires and intentions for the RCA, and, you know, there was a timeline there and it wasn't met. So, you know, this is significant in that they are standing alone. That's the one thing I'd say. It's not Ascot and other large independents also going with them at the same time. We wait with bated breath to see whether they'll follow suit. I guess the main question we have now is, A, what happens next? And B, what could happen that would influence the other large independents making the decision to either stay or leave?
Yeah, absolutely. And Jonathan, what's clear, and I've spoken with Felicity Barnard, Ascot Chief Executive, and you can see that interview on our digital platforms and then in Tuesday's newspaper. What is clear, Jonathan, from what Fliss has said in her statement and in the wider interview, is that Ascot and the other signatories made it very clear to the RCA, whose chair is Will Walsh and now led by Alex Seed, Chief Executive, who was the Chief Executive of the LIs, they were very clear that they wanted to see a plan for change. They wanted to see a plan to restructure the RCA's governance system, if you like, that would enable better decision-making. Ascot's line is that at the end of April, no such plan had been put forward. Ascot wasn't happy, satisfied with the proposals that had been discussed over the last 2 months, and feels that if any of those proposals actually were put forward, they wouldn't be robust enough. So Ascot's view is that we set you a deadline, you haven't met the deadline, and therefore we are going to be true to our word and we are announcing our intention to leave. I suspect, well, I'm sure, that Ascot would not have believed it would be the only one to make that move. I think Ascot would have been entitled to expect that the other signatories to the letter would have taken the same position. Why, therefore, have those others, knowing that they set the RCA a deadline, that deadline has not been met, why have they not been true to their word?
Look, it's a question for them. It wouldn't surprise me at all if the position at those, particularly the large independents, the likes of Goodwood, I'm sure their position is the same at Ascot, whether they've been caught on the back foot by the announcement or whether they've just decided, well, we'll let Ascot break away and then we'll follow it and we'll see kind of how it's received and then go again. Like, certainly from a PR and comms perspective, there's no need. I see why Ascot would be surprised, because generally those tracks do sing from the same hymn sheet. I think the Jockey Club's slightly different just due to the nature of the members and the structures, and it's slightly more, there's probably a little bit more bureaucracy there, and they're possibly just having, it's harder for the Jockey Club to be seen to be the agitator, given it has to work in the best interest of British racing and slightly coming at it from a slightly different point of view. So I think from their perspective, you can see why they would just say, well, we'll be seen to be giving it every chance, even if they've already decided they're going to pull out, which I don't know that. But I can see why, if I was working there in the sort of comms department, why there's a benefit to just letting it play out for a little bit longer, be seen to be coming to the table and trying to compromise and then just going from there.
We should also bear in mind, Lee, that we were speaking about before we came on air, Ascot still have the right to rejoin the RCA. Obviously, they're not going to officially leave until the end of the year. But I personally can't imagine, given that they've made this choice, that they would row back on it now.
No, and to be fair, Felice Barnard has said to me that if this three-month review, 12-week review, does yield a meaningful, substantial reform plan, then they could reconsider that decision. But the fact that in the 2 months in which negotiations, talks have been taking place, nothing really was put forward that would have satisfied Ascot, that would seem unlikely. What is also interesting, as I said earlier on, is that the RCA, the Racecourse Association, is the shareholder in the BHA. So if you're not in the RCA, which, as an example, Plumpton is not, Toaster wasn't when it ceased to be a racecourse, if you're not in the RCA, in effect, you're not an official part of that BHA family. Now, I put to Felice Barnard, is that a concern? And it was very much not a concern in the sense that they are represented on the commercial committee, they're represented through the large independents, and there's also that sense that Ascot is so big, as I said, the most famous racecourse in the world, the most successful racecourse in Britain, a racecourse is currently doing extremely well. It's almost inconceivable that Ascot isn't part of, if you like, the way the sport is run. And going forward, however, there is that situation whereby the BHA's articles make clear that if at any point it becomes obvious that the RCA is not the best organisation, not the natural organisation to represent the owners of British racecourses on the BHA, that the RCA can be replaced by a different organisation. And if we reach a point at the end of this year where it's not just Ascot, but the Jockey Club and the other LIs who cease to be members of the RCA, it is surely inconceivable that the RCA has a long-term future as certainly as the sole representative of racecourses within British racing governance.
I think you could have stopped that sentence at long-term future, surely. If all of those major tracks leave the RCA, it surely ceases to be the racecourse representative body. That might be harsh because obviously it represents a plethora. But there's two questions here. Is what happens to the RCA now? And I'd love to hear from them, to be honest.
Yeah.
And secondly, what does that mean for the way racecourses are represented on the BHA board, notwithstanding the independent board, which is sort of an adjacent issue? To me, the issue from the conversations I've had has always been that what works for Ascot and works for Goodwood is completely different.
Yeah.
Completely different business model, completely different commercially to a smaller independent track, as an example, to an arena racing company owned track, as an example. Could we reach a situation whereby you have two governing bodies for racecourses? Maybe the large independents, they already have the large independents body. Maybe that is their governing body. And then we have another one that looks after the other tracks. I don't know. I'm against any unnecessary complicating of an already really challenging governance structure that the sport has. But at the same time, I do see the logic, having spoken to a lot of racecourse executives, that trying to govern Manchester City in the same way you govern Salford City are completely different. Completely
Absolutely.
Different.
I think this just highlights, doesn't it, how we know the sport is fragmented and we know that different entities work in their own interests, but this just highlights that even more in the fact that, you know, if the biggest racecourse in the world cannot proceed with, you know, confidence that what they need and what they think is their best vision for the sport cannot be enforced. But then, as you've said, there are solutions, I guess, in theory, but who's to say they're going to be any better? It's hard to have confidence in any route going forward. So as much as I think, in a way, change is refreshing and it's good that Ascot have almost put their money where their mouth is, it could result in just an even bigger tug of war with the racecourses and the RCA in general.
Yeah, absolutely. And that point about they're having different business models, again, Ascot recognises that ARC's business model, the business model of some of the smaller independents, is, as you say, Jonathan, completely different to theirs. And I don't think there's any inference to take from Ascot's announcement that they believe that it is wrong for those racecourses to pursue those business models. I think it's the problem is that trying to, as you say, satisfy those different models, those different ambitions within one structure is very difficult.
Particularly if all of those racecourses are on an equal footing.
Yes.
You know, should there be some sort of proportionate representation in the RCA?
Because at the moment it's a one-member, one-vote system.
Yeah, and should... These are just... I'm not saying this should happen, but is there an argument that an Ascot, that a jockey club that has Cheltenham, Epsom, Aintree, that's bringing in what it's bringing into the sport, should they get priority? I don't know. And when I say
or at least be more proportionate.
Proportional, yeah. Or maybe they have different vote. Maybe you change the voting structure on certain things. Maybe you, you know, somehow differentiate between the racecourses. I don't know. While it, in a in a utopia, every racecourse gets one vote and it's a really lovely way of doing things. But ultimately, you can't. Mm-hmm. It seems to me, and the feeling I get is that you can't have a trade body that is sort of dealing with such a plethora of different business models and interests. You can't keep them all happy, and that's basically what's happened. And when I say different business models, I don't mean better.
No, just different.
You know, I'm not saying Ascot is better than these smaller independents. They are just different. And as such, how can you govern them in the same... how can you treat them in the same way? And that's where this frustration's come from, clearly.
Yeah, and I think Ascot's position is that the structure as it stands at the moment has been a factor in the mess that we've seen over the last 18 months, an active contributing factor in the mess surrounding Charles Allen, surrounding the failure to really implement the sort of structure governance reform that I think most people would say British racing needs. And I think that's one point. I think Ascot's decision underlines how severe the situation is. If Ascot is doing this, really does hammer home.
It's quite a surprise, wasn't it? I think the
one reason why it's a surprise is that for as long as I've been doing racing journalism and reporting on industry matters, there's always been a sense in which Ascot has been, if you like, a backseat player in racing politics. Now, while the racecourse will have been involved in on committees and in conversations, and you know they would have been expressing their views, I think there was historically always a sense that because it is the Crown's racecourse, because in effect the Queen, the former Queen and now the King, in effect is the owner of the racecourse, because of that royal connection, it was felt it almost wasn't right or fitting for Ascot to be seen to be playing in the murky, sometimes rough world of racing politics. The fact that that has very much changed under leadership of Felicity Barnard and Sir Francis Brooke, the Ascot chair, I think is indicative of not just a change to Ascot's position in terms of racing politics and wanting to be front and centre, but the sense that Ascot wants to be seen as a leader in British racing and really wants to make its voice heard and almost pull the sport in what it considers to be a right and positive direction.
And
that is a significant change.
They've ultimately been forced that way.
Yeah.
It's crucial as well that they talk about in the sport's best interests, and you know we know anecdotally that oftentimes when racecourses talk about the sport's interests, they're actually referring to their own interests. I think I take that sincerely from Ascot when they say that this is done in the interests of pulling the sport forward. And the Jockey Club is sort of striking a similar message in the statement today. They said it would be sad to leave the RCA. They want these changes for the sport's best interest, for decisive decision making. Those statements, if you put Ascot's and Jockey Clubs next to each other, okay, Ascot's taken the leap, but they are essentially saying the same things. It's just the Jockey Club's been willing to give the RCA a bit of a reprieve for now, emphasis on for now. The thing that came up in both, and very strongly in the Jockey Club statement, was we need the views and needs of racecourses from across the pyramid to be fairly represented. And that, it seems to me, to be the crux of the issue.
And what surely also is the crux of the issue is that the Jockey Club and the other allies, or the, and the allies apart from Ascot, have given, if you like, the RCA 3 months' notice to put forward a plan that satisfies everybody. I think many would say it is surprising and disappointing that they haven't gone with Ascot's position at the moment. But if in where we would be end of July, the RCA still hasn't come forward with a satisfactory response, then at that point, surely those other race courses have to go in the same direction.
I'm surprised. I'm surprised the large independents, the Jockey Club, I can understand to an extent, given the various things at play there. But the large independents, I'm surprised that it wasn't a coordinated statement as per the letter. Yeah. I'm very surprised at that. I don't know why that is. And also with relation to this, there's still, it's quite murky around this 12-week governance review. It's mentioned in the Jockey Club statement, but I don't know if I've seen anything from the RCA itself saying this is what's happening, this is what we're committed to. At time of recording, we haven't heard from the RCA. We might get out of here and they've issued a robust defence of everything they do, but it sounds as though that's not going to be the case, and that in itself is also a little bit disappointing.
One bit of good news for the RCA today, and it is a bit of good news, is that the RCA is a tenant of Ascot Racecourse. Its offices are on Ascot Racecourse land, and Ascot has confirmed it has no plans to evict the RCA. So it's no need to find a new home, and it needs a bit of good news today. Yeah. And maybe that was a small piece.
It does. And also, just look, there is the serious side to the RCA and its future if it ceases to exist. There's a lot of very talented people involved in that organisation who are facing uncertainty in light of this. So it's a challenging one.
Yeah.
And it's one that came from nowhere, right? Well, not from nowhere. And we heard the murmurings. We all knew that there was a little bit of disquiet around from some of the race courses about how they're represented by the RCA, which is what you'd expect from any trade body, that you're always going to have a few grumblings. But hot on the heels of Lord Allen, for that statement to come through, it took me by surprise, and I was working that day. I didn't see that coming at all.
No.
It's going to be fascinating to see how it plays out, to be honest with you.
I suppose we should say that running the RCA is probably not the easiest job in the world. Trying to satisfy all those different constituent members is not an easy job, and Wilf Walsh is the chair of the RCA is a serious operator with a big background. They've now got Alex Eden as chief executive, and Alex previously led the large independents. So Alex was previously leading one of the signatories to the letter, or a number of the signatories to the letter that have called for change. So his position is very interesting on this. So they've got some big people in those jobs, but they now face a 3 month period that will probably determine the future existence of the Racecourse Association.
It just speaks to the whole governance of the sport. You always extrapolate, these stories break and it's big news, and then you just extrapolate and extrapolate it, and it all comes down to the fact that it would be really fun to just set fire to how British racing is structured and governed and start again from scratch, because it is a complete mess.
So, you know what we think about this situation then? What do you think? Let us know by using the comments section on the video and engaging with our socials. The racing at Ascot on Saturday and Friday. It's the Victoria Cup on Saturday. That is one of this weekend's big races. We've also got the Derby and Oaks Trials at Lingfield. We've got the French Guineas at Longchamp. We've got the Chester May meeting to look forward to this week. But looking back, we had the Guineas Festival at Newmarket and two classics that produced two very impressive dominant winners. True Love got Aidan O'Brien and Ballydore back on the Guineas Roll of Honour after an unusually long absence for them on Sunday. But Maddie, on Saturday we had the 2000 Guineas, a race that had lost a number of big names in the run-up to the first Saturday in May. Some questioned the strength of the race, albeit it looked competitive. And yet in the end, we had one of the most impressive, striking Guineas winning performances of recent years, of modern times, with Boeco beating Stad by 2¾ lengths, with 8 lengths back to the third. It was a massive performance.
It was, and there's two elements to this success, I think. There's the first one, which is the horse, and what a remarkable performance it was. I must admit, I thought maybe his juvenile form isn't as strong as we thought at the time. Physically, I know a lot of people remarked in the paddock, he's not a very imposing horse. But to do that first time out, and the thing that struck me was, as you say, not necessarily the distance between him and Stard, but the distance back to Distant Storm in third. And those were the three protagonists, really. You know, Stard and Distant Storm were sent off co-favourites. Was remarkable. His turn of foot to seal the race, sort of coming into out of the dip, was extraordinary. It was really dominant. It was the, I think, the joint highest on RPRs since Frankel with Dawn Approach, who won by about 5 lengths. So it's magnificent. Great to see a real standout performance with the return of the flat. But I guess another strand of what I enjoyed about the race so much was the fact that it was Billy Lochney, you know, 20 years old to be winning his first classic. And there was a real sense of, with him and George Bowie, a sense of huge belief in this horse, and pressure and intensity, that after the race I thought it was so refreshing how the jubilation that emanated from it. You know, Billy was bigging up the horse, getting the crowd into raptures. He was absolutely, you know, so open with his emotions, and I think it was so infectious. You know, nothing against Aidan O'Brien, Ryan Moore, they are the ultimate professionals, and that's why they're operating at the standard they are, but we've become used to quite a sanitized reality in these big classics where, you know, the same sort of lines are trotted out afterwards and it's all very respectable and very professional. And, you know, that's, we can't all react to things in the same way. Of course, they're entitled to do that, and that's why they're as good as they are. But I just thought it was a real fillip to have this real fresh energy around a big classic winner. You've got two relatively young, well, in Billy's case, definitely young, and with George still very up and coming, players in terms of a jockey and a trainer who are just at the top of their game, who are burgeoning, who are, you know, just lovers of the sport. And I thought that energy was just really infectious. I thought it was really good to see. Made some wonderful photographs from Ed Whittaker with Billy sort of standing up in the irons and saluting the crowd. Made me feel really invigorated about the upcoming flat season. And that takes absolutely nothing away from True Love, who was also brilliant in her own right on Sunday. But yeah, it gave me a really, really great feeling. And now we'll be able to see whether this horse can emerge as the standout miler of his generation. And that's what they want to make him into. First impressions are there's no reason why he can't. You know, as I say, the right horses were there at the tail end of the race. It seemed an honest, well-run guineas. And we'll see if he can go on from this, presumably at Royal Ascot.
Yeah, absolutely. You'd imagine he'd go for the St James's Palace, maybe via the Irish Guineas. Stad, I'd imagine, would definitely go for the Irish Guineas. Michael Table was saying yesterday that he thought Stad was the bet of the Ballydore horses.
That's what the market said,
absolutely,
wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a big move from during the day. Ultimately, however, Jonathan, Aidan O'Brien's enthusiasm in the minutes leading up to the Guineas convinced Michael to have a few quid on True Love. That was rewarded. She, in the end, was a dominant winner of the 1,000 guineas. As I say, Aidan hadn't won one of the Newmarket Classics since 2021, which for him is a long time, possibly reflective of a changing approach to the guineas and a recognition that is a long year. And often, as Aidan said with Stad, he was just really starting out. Mm-hmm. So it was a starting point for him, not an end point. But True Love, a filly who'd already had a run and a win this season. Huge, big girl. She was really impressive. As I thought was her groom, Siobhan Bergen, after the race, who spoke glowingly about the filly and Aidan. Aidan spoke glowingly about her as well. And why I was keen to reference that in the piece is that we hear him talking about team all the time, and he did that again on Sunday. But the way she spoke underlined that. But also, when I asked him about her, now, this isn't meant as a slur on trainers, but some trainers, you ask about a winning groom after a race and they're not sure of the name, certainly not the surname. Aidan knew her name, but also knew her backstory. that as a girl, she'd stood at the gates of Ballydore watching the boxes coming in. She'd watched the gallops from a hill. You know, she absolutely loves the game. And I thought that was quite endearing.
Yeah, that came across. And sometimes it is challenging when it is a winning machine like Aidan O'Brien, like Ballydoyle, and they're churning out these Group 1 wins and Classic wins. And they're very keen. Aidan O'Brien's always very keen to thank people, as he should be. And it can feel a little bit like rinse and repeat. And that's not to say the feat itself is not incredible, of course. And these are amazing horses, and every horse brings an amazing story to it. I'm not saying it's all the same, but sometimes it is nice when you're able to identify that sort of slightly more human angle outside of this winning machine of one of the perhaps smaller cogs in it. And it's a really romantic story, isn't it? Watching Ballydoyle and fantasizing about working there, and then leading up a filly like True Love, as well as many other champions as well, by the sounds of it.
Yeah, Mini Hawk, Diamond Necklace this week.
Yeah, it was really lovely quotes, I thought, and a very good performance. I wouldn't surprise me if Precise ended up achieving more long term.
Yeah.
I think just on the basis of the 2-year-old form, first start of the season, you see her maybe reversing it, but True Love's amazing to look at. And the slightly ominous thing is this suggestion that Diamond Necklace might be the best of all of them.
Yeah, she goes as favourite in the Pro Leash on Sunday. And just from, if you forgive me, personal angle, I thought it was great from an Epsom perspective that Into the Sky runs such a massive race in the 2,000 guineas on for Jim Boyle. I'm really confirmed that Epsom has a proper Group 1, well, hopefully a Group 1 class. Or...
Sorry, I thought you were going to congratulate Jonathan on his success in the tipping competition. I wasn't having that.
He's still bitter.
So Jonathan and I both, we have to pick three horses on a Saturday in this hotly contested race in both tipping competition. Mr. Harding and myself both had Boeco in the guineas and Knight Raider in the Palace House. I also tipped to a racehorse bookmaker in our B&B having breakfast on Saturday morning. He kept him on side, so I think I've contributed there. But we also picked one more horse. I picked Saida Darian in the opening race at Newmarket on Saturday. Harding went with a 4-6 shot. What was a 4-6 shot? 4-6 shot again?
I can't remember.
Blue Bolt.
That's the one. Yeah, Andrew Boulding.
So he diddled me with a 4-6 shot.
Anyway.
You're better off doing what I did and having three losers. You know, at least there were big prices. I went down on my sword.
Yeah, you make a fair point. You make a fair
point.
No, I'm
kidding.
You went down with honour there. You referenced winning machines earlier on, Jonathan, which is clearly you in the tipping competition because you're a multiple winner of that. But Willie Mullins, also winning machine, just briefly, Punchestown Festival was fantastic as ever. The three of Willie's championship winners, Galopande Sean, Gaelic Warrior, Lossy Mouth and Il Était Temps, all impressive winners, all fantastic performances, particularly Gaelic Warrior, who the previous week had been named Racing Post Horse of the Year by you, Racing Post readers. He was sublime in the Punchestown Gold Cup.
Yeah, he is. He is just the best horse of the year. It's a wonderful performance. It shouldn't be underestimated how challenging it can be to back up winning a Gold Cup, because there have been countless horses that has left a real mark on them winning that race or even running well in that race. So for him to follow it up in the manner, not just follow it up and win, but in the manner he did it, speaks to his constitution. It speaks to Willie Mullins' ability to keep these horses on the go, going in the right direction for what is, much like with Aidan O'Brien, a very long season, and he's always been aware of that. I remember just before Christmas or at the start of the season, we're talking about Willie Mullins has made an uncharacteristically slow start, and there was even a little inkling of could Gordon Elliott do it still going into Punchestown with the lead. But you just know Willie Mullins gets those big horses right when it counts, which is at the end of the season, and at Punchestown he's so dominant, and so it proved.
When you consider Gaelic Warrior's been on the go ever since that, you know, titanic John Durkin struggle, I mean, really is an excellent training performance. He just seems to be more professional now, doesn't he? I mean, I've long been one of his knockers and thought he was a bit quirky and a bit sort of over-enthusiastic, but he seems to have just channeled that, and he's just relentless in the way that he gallops. He's got great speed that he brings to these staying races, doesn't he? And I think that's his main asset.
Yeah, he's a sensational horse. And a stable that has a lot of sensational horses. Paul Nicholls, as a trainer, no longer at the moment has as many of those type horses as he once had. And albeit he had another really successful season. He finished fourth in the table. He had a number of blows during last summer when losing some high-profile horses from big owners. Lost the likes of Old Park Sty, went on to win the Supreme Novices Hurdle, Cabral de Matan, who's been a very good horse for Dan Skelton. And there was more bad news for Paul Nicholls last week when it was announced that Johnny and Samantha Delahaye, a couple whose silks are very well known, have had some very good horses with Paul, including Siername and Pete Doherty. They announced their decision to remove all their horses from Ditchet. They thanked Paul Nicholls for his service to them over the years, and they said they had just decided that they want to take a different approach and split their horses. Majority have gone to Dan Skelton, but they didn't keep any of their horses with Paul Nicholls. He replied, gave a very magnanimous response, but clearly, Maddie, it is a significant development for Paul.
Yeah, it's becoming something of a trend, isn't it? And I think owners' attitudes, it makes sense, doesn't it? If several are flying the nest, you probably naturally look around and go, well, hang on, why are they doing that? Should I be doing something different? We don't know the ins and outs of this specific decision from the Delahayes, but it's certainly a worrying time for Paul and his team. You know, they're, as ever, incredibly focused on maintaining their high level of performance and their form. And there's been changes afoot. You know, we know the relationship with Tom Malone broke down somewhat. We know that Megan Nicholls, Paul's daughter, is now going to be an increasing figure in sourcing the bloodstock. But yeah, it's been a very challenging few seasons for Paul. And we've still seen how he is able to operate with fewer superstars in his yard. Obviously, the structure of his yard's going to change again next season when he doesn't have Harry Cobden riding most of his horses. So we're really looking now for Paul to respond in some way, particularly given what Dan Skelton, his old protege, has gone on to do. There are sort of winds of change in the jump racing training ranks. And, you know, I'm sure I speak for everyone when we want to see Paul back where he belongs, you know, challenging for trainers' championships, and he can definitely still do that. But you need the horses, and at the minute he hasn't got them.
I think so, there's like a broader point here. A lot of Paul Nicholls' success was with what you might call an old school type of owner. I think he's been quoted as saying this before. You know, these very loyal, very, we let the trainer do the job type. And I just think that there's a sort of change in ownership, perhaps in terms of patience. Owners seem increasingly keen to move horses, obviously in follow fashion. No one would begrudge anyone moving a horse to Willie Mullins or Dan Skelton, because they're the two that are on top at the moment. But I do think there's an element of Paul Nicholls in a perfect storm of losing a lot of those big owners, yeah, just simply because they're no longer with us, very sadly. And then kind of his approach, whether that runs well alongside
momentum,
the new
as
wave
well,
of ownership
it?
And momentum.
Yeah.
But look, what I would say is it's there to see what Paul Nicholls has achieved.
Yeah.
We all know how he's wired. You'd be very brave to write him off. It wouldn't surprise me at all if he gets backed. He's got some really strong, good, loyal backers. I think there will be more down the line. You never know where the next big horse or the next big owner is coming from.
Yeah.
And given his obsession with succeeding, I think there's been a lot of people on social media which grated me a little bit, saying, well, that's him done. Is he going to pack up? I can tell you now, I'd be amazed.
And I think you made the point about big owners. Jed Mason, one of those big owners, was very quick to go on social media and say that don't write off Paul. You know, we're continuing to support him, and we'll do so with good horses. And just in a wider point, clearly, any owner is entitled to send their horse to whatever trainer they want. They pay the bills, and they pay a lot of money to both buy horses and keep horses in training. And no trainer has a right to expect an owner to retain their loyalty, their association with the yard. And it's also true that owners remove horses from yards for all manner of reasons. And Paul spoke about some of that towards the end of last year. And sometimes it's because they're not happy with how a horse has been trained. Sometimes it's a personal matter with the trainer. What I found particularly, I suppose, regrettable about this decision by the Delahayes was the decision to remove Pete Doherty an 11-year-old who'd spent all his career at Ditchett, had done incredibly well for them as owners because of the way he'd been trained by Paul Nicholls. And I thought the decision to remove Pick Doherty going towards his 12-year-old season was a cold decision, and one that I thought was perfect. It was pretty saddening and regrettable.
I'd agree. It's hard, isn't it? Because I don't know the ins and outs of the relationship, or we don't know. It was all very cordial afterwards, but we don't know what's gone on. But like you, that was the one that shocked me. I think if you're what I'd like to have seen, and I'm not in a position, I don't own loads of horses. If it were me in a hypothetical world, I would like to think maybe transitioning or maybe moving some of the younger horses or sending them to different places and just doing it over even two seasons as opposed to just abruptly taking them all. You know, is there any merit in that? I don't know. But with Pick Doherty, what, for me, why would you not just leave him there and let him stick to his familiar routines and maybe win a couple more big races and retire very happily?
You touched upon this, Lee, but I think so many horses I can name from the Paul Nicholls yard who I think would not have won the amount of prize money that they would have done with other trainers. I mean, that's what Paul's best at. It's placing horses and optimising their careers. And I think absolutely he did that with Pick Doherty. So it is a shame that he's been moved. I mean, you know, he's clearly in the twilight of his career anyway now. So whether we get to see him quite at his best for another trainer another season, that remains to be seen. But it's interesting, I guess, on a wider point, where are the next big jump owners coming from? You know, we see JP McManus, he's obviously got the new line with Dan Skelton, and he spreads his horses out a bit more. But, you know, Paul, he's lost, as you say, the Barbers, the Stewart.
Well, the Barbers, Paul Barbers died, but his family is still involved in.
Yes, but not to the same degree that they once were. Similar comments apply to the Stewart family.
Yeah.
You know, he lost Andy Stewart. Where are these new people and these new investors in our sport going to come from? And what happens when, you know, gosh forbid, we don't have JP McManus? It's going to be a very interesting time for British racing coming up.
And the reality, as I mentioned it in a Dan Skelton big release recently, is that Willie Mullins has shown us that there's an increasing trend that the big owners want to be with the person they perceive to be the number one trainer. The number trainer almost becomes a status symbol for those big owners who flock to that person. That happened in Ireland, and it's happening with Dan Skelton.
Yeah, it makes sense.
It does make sense.
It makes sense.
Okay, an awful lot discussed there in this week's edition. Jonathan, Maddie, thank you very much indeed. Thank you to you for watching. Enjoy Chester this week. Enjoy the weekend's racing and follow closely what happens on the Racecourse Association and Ascot front. And also this week we get a decision from the Gambling Commission in relation to affordability checks, and we probably need to gird our loins for that one. Until then, though, until all that comes, thanks for watching and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.